www.sightline.org, and that's SIGHTLINE. And the flashcards are really just sort of talking points memos that folks can get sent to their email a couple times a month. And what I do in my work, Sightline's a public policy think tank, and our focus is mostly on climate, energy, transportation, and economy questions. And my work is really about translating kind of complex, dense, wonky policy and science into regular language that the rest of us can understand and relate to. And so the flashcards are just sort of tools for communicators to make our messages about climate and energy resonate with more people.
Right. And resonating seems to be a big part of what needs to be happening. These facts that people aren't talking about it, could you talk about that just a little bit? That's a huge issue right now, isn't it? That we're not going to get action unless we do start talking about it, but that isn't happening.
Right. And there are all kinds of reasons why people aren't talking about it. There are certainly some psychological barriers that I think we all experience. My contention is that there's a little bit of a denier in everybody, even in someone like me who's immersed in the climate science and policy solutions basically every day. I still have a hard time kind of grappling with the gravity and some of the fear and anxiety that climate change brings up for me. I look at my 4-year-old daughter, for example, and think about what her future holds. And I think the tendency, even for someone who's, you know, in the top 1% of concerned about the issue and engaged in the issue, is sort of protecting ourselves from all of that kind of fear and anxiety that climate change brings up. And I can outline sort of some of the other kinds of psychological barriers that I think people experience.
Okay,
that's the starting place.
Yeah, I think that's good. Maybe really briefly, we could just touch on and then get back to the fear part of it, is the fact that we're also dealing with a kind of a multi-billion-dollar disinformation campaign here. I mean,
absolutely.
As much as we're trying to get the message out, other people are actually telling us it's not even happening.
Exactly, and you know, like I said, they are able to tap into this thread that I think all of us hold, where that part of us wants to jump at any little tidbit of information that makes us feel the hardcore deniers. But there are other things kind of working against climate change as kind of a communications challenge.
Let's get into some of that.
Sure. It's an abstract problem. It's been cast as distant in time and place. The science is complex. The solutions are complex and not always, something that everybody would want to do,
right.
Like change the way we use energy. We often focus on the Arctic, on polar bears, on people in places that are far away. And that's changing a little bit with some of the ways that people are talking about extreme weather. But we see even in the media that extreme weather covered as such, just kind of crazy weather without putting them into the context of climate change. There's also the fact that, and research and psychological studies sort of bear the constant drumbeat of gloom and doom about climate change can actually shut us down, and it can have sort of a paralyzing solutions and the opportunities involved with solutions. We can actually open more people up to having conversations about the problem. What else?
Yeah.
there are a lot of barriers, unfortunately, and that's what makes this work so important, and I'm really glad that you're starting this conversation here today. There's another factor that's sort of a vicious cycle. It's like, if nobody at the top is doing much about it, then we can push it out of our mind as not being that big of a deal. That's particularly true in the U.S., where we sort of talk about it as a problem, but then the policy solutions don't follow, and sort of relegated to an environmental problem. And there are certainly a lot of people who do not under any circumstances self-identify as an environmentalist. In fact,
right.
that's a turnoff. So that frame can sort of obscure all the other issues that are tied up with climate disruption, from health issues to economic and security issues, and all the opportunities, frankly, that are tied up in shifting from dirty fuels to clean, abundant energy.
So basically what's going on is it's just such a, it's kind of like a problem that doesn't really work for our sort of our human brain in a way. It's what I get. It's like we're sort of primed to deal with a problem that's immediate. We like to put things in a sort of a narration of good guys and bad guys, but actually the problem is all of us.
Right.
And
we're the bad guy too,
yeah.
Which is difficult. And, you know, a lot of the messengers who are charged with talking about climate change tend to be folks who deal in facts and data. And we know from just observing, but also from looking at polling over the last 10 plus years, that piling on more facts and data is just not working. But it's rare that you'll see economists or scientists talking about sort of their personal or emotional investment in finding solutions. But we know from other fields, you know, from neuroscience and social sciences, that emotion is really sort of the potent source of motivation that drives human behavior. We don't actually make decisions based on facts and data, even though we'd like to believe that we're rational creatures. We actually kind of make decisions with our gut or our heart more than our brain.
Yeah, but as you said, if it turns into like total, utter despair, we just shut down, I think.
Yeah, and like I said earlier, I mean, I sense that even in myself. You know, if we thought about this all the time, we would become overwhelmed. And but if we shift to sort of talking about solutions, we do find that more people come along. So the polling, public opinion data that we do track, shows that if you just talk about the problem, people shut down, they default to the denial stance. And they don't want to talk about it. But if you talk about solutions and what we could do and sort of the economic and local job opportunities involved with clean energy and efficiency, that you actually get more people on board saying they accept the science. So, you know, there are strategies for bringing more people into the conversation.
Yeah, I saw something that they talked to some skeptics or deniers, but they first were just talking about geothermal ways, you know, these technological fixes for the climate. And the group that had that conversation was actually more willing then to sort of consider that climate change was actually happening, whereas the other group still said, no, there's no way, it's not happening at all. So
right.
Even that kind of thing can, like, get people
sure.
at least into the conversation.
I've witnessed this taking place, you know, in a two-hour focus group where the first hour we mostly talked about the problem and the impacts and sort of that earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, most of the participants were kind of dragging their feet on accepting the science. And then in the second half, we talked about solutions and you know, all the technologies and know-how and policy solutions that are readily available to us to, you know, to start up right now as soon as we want to. And suddenly the attitudes about the science were shifted.
Wow.
It was quite remarkable, actually.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. So I'm speaking, this is the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. I'm speaking with Anna Fahey about different ways that we might be able to start talking about the climate change, climate crisis, catastrophic climate chaos. You know, maybe we can use some of these words for it too. Maybe that's too gloom and doom. Anyway, and she's a expert on Communitude, an environmental think tank based in Seattle, Washington. And you're welcome to call in with your comments or questions. And actually, if you're a skeptic, that would be great. Maybe we could have a real conversation with you and see where it might go. The phone number here at KBOO is 503-231-8187, and all questions and comments are quite welcome. So, Anna, there are people out here working on this issue, and you have a bunch of different, you know, recommendations through your blogs that you've been doing with Sightline. And do you have a couple that are kind of your favorite, you know, ways or techniques for, like, dealing with this?
Sure. I mean, the standard political calculus, if you're running some kind of paid campaign to, you know, move forward with some kind of policy solution on climate change, is that you don't spend a lot of your time trying to convince those who are in the hardcore denier camp. That's not necessarily the best place to spend your money and time. But all of us find ourselves in situations, either personally or professionally, where we're confronted with, you know, folks on some, you know, some point on the denier spectrum where we feel like we might have an opportunity to open up lines of communication in a positive way. So I would say some people you'll never convince. It's not worth getting into some kind of heated debate about climate change with the most radical of those.
Right.
But there are some ways to kind of open up communication. I would say in any communication, not just with those who are kind of opposed in attitudes to yours, but I would start with saying what you believe and exactly why it matters to you. Of course, it's also by just stating the facts. Often we assume that the science is kind of understood. We hear so much about it. But really, we just need to reiterate that human activities, especially burning coal and oil and gasoline, are overloading our atmosphere. And the result is a warming climate.
We've just lost you?
No, I'm here.
What's up? Oh, hello? Maybe we can take this question while we're happening. Hello?
Hello?
Hi.
This Stephanie? This
yeah,
is,
we have a... We'll
hi.
Take your question.
Paul Cienfuegos. I just have a really different impression about how you actually break through the climate change crisis, and I really actually don't think that the problem is that enough people aren't talking about it. I think the problem is that we're continuing to assume that sooner or later it's going to be the policyholders and the state and federal government who are going to solve this problem rather than we, the people, exercising our authority to solve it directly. And I'm just wondering whether whether your guest has any thoughts about, you know, community rights movement that's building around the country, and whether she has ideas about how local communities can actually use their democratic authority to pass laws directly about climate change.
Okay, hang on. I'm going to see if we've got her back again. Is Anna there? Hi. Do we have Anna? Anna, did you catch Paul's question? Anna? Okay, we have a little bit of a glitch again. Anna?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Great. So, and then Paul was asking, he thinks, what was it again, Paul, that you think that people are basically trying just to wait for policy holders to deal with this, but that...
Yeah, I think that we have really the wrong strategy as activists on the climate change issue, that we're waiting for federal and state policy holders to protect us from the climate crisis rather than understanding that we the people, the sovereign people, who have the authority to govern ourselves, to pass laws, and that the community rights movement that I'm part of has been trying to get people, you know, locally to understand that we could actually be tackling climate change at the local level directly through self-governance. And I'm just wondering if Anna has had any experience with that or interest in that strategy.
Anna?
Great question, and thank you for the work that you're doing. I would there are so many things to say. I mean, the issue of climate change and policy inaction at every level brings up so many other kind of issues and concerns that we have right now about governance in general, and the way our democracy is working or not working for people. And Stephanie mentioned earlier that there's this concerted and well-funded campaign for denying climate change. That also represents a big load of money that is sort of rigging the system against the very thing that you're talking about, is sort of the people's will to dictate what our future is going to be and what our kids' future is going to be. Big oil and big coal are the clear sort of villains in this. I mean, our brains kind of need a narrative form to understand and make sense of the world. And I advocate for talking about climate change as something that we can tackle, something that we have a moral imperative to tackle, and frankly, an issue that we shouldn't allow to be decided by big money interests who are trying to protect their profits, future to be decided by the CEOs of big oil companies. I can't speak to sort of the self-governance work that you're doing per se, but I think that the climate issue taps into some bigger problems about how we make decisions for ourselves and how money.
And I think also, though, that we're dealing with the fact that people, there are activists, but when I realize that so many people are really standing on the sidelines with this, and part of it is because they're hanging out with other people who are standing on the sidelines, it's like how to bring those people into the activist realm, I guess, is kind of what I'm interested in. And wondering, Anna, if you feel like your work is sort of addressing that.
I do. I mean, my current obsession is sort of figuring out how to get those, not the deniers at all. Again, I think maybe we can save our energy and focus on the folks who are actually concerned, people who are already taking steps in their personal use less energy, people who bring their reusable grocery bags to the store and, you know, maybe even drive a super efficient car, who are frankly either overwhelmed or, like you say, kind of culturally bound to inaction, and figuring out how do we get those people to think about this more and to have their voices heard a little bit more often is one of the things that I'm trying to figure out in my work. And I don't have all the answers, but I do feel that we need to talk about these things in more human terms. Talk about our kids, talk about our values, our family, our hopes and dreams for the future, talk about why we're angry that nothing is happening, and, you know, make it more of an issue of personal, local, and immediate concern.
As opposed to a bunch of scientific facts. We have another caller.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question, and who are you?
My name is John.
Hi, John. What's up?
Well, you know, I really kind of hate the rain on anybody's parade. You know, I agree with the bumper sticker, think globally, act locally, right? However, when I'm around and around at work, I work in a really ultra-conservative environment, the people. And so their whole thing is, there are two things that they point out. Well, this is just a natural occurrence. There's been ice sheets, you know, 20, 30, 40,000 years ago, and now it's just kind of happening again. And second, well, India and China aren't doing anything, and they're part of the world, so we're eating their dust. So, you know, screw it.
Yeah, those are the kinds of things, Anna. How do we respond to that kind of stuff?
Well, we hear those a lot, don't we?
Yeah.
And, you know, I would go to take a deep breath and go to the place where you can talk about solutions and opportunities. We actually know that Americans of all political stripes agree that clean energy is the right direction for the country, and that, frankly, the faster the better. This is conservatives to progressives. Americans agree across the board that we should cut our fossil fuel use, and that it'll make our economy stronger in the near and long term.
And we'll be independent of foreign interests.
Okay, well, however, our own government is working against us. This XL pipeline from, you know, Canada to Texas, I mean, that's going through. You know that,
yeah.
And I know that.
I fear, I share your fears on that one.
Our own progressive president is backing this. And, you know, this guy named Dr. Hansen, he's been screaming on top of his lungs, you know, we're going over 400 parts, you know, per million. I mean, are we going to walk like the dinosaurs?
I think where we're coming from with this is that it is incredibly urgent. But until people wake up to the fact that it is this urgent, we're going to just keep, you know, nothing's happening.
Well, that's my frustration, and
yeah.
I'm almost throwing in the towel because I just quit dialoguing with these people. I mean, they're all retired military people. They got theirs. They got their pensions, and they're getting another pension from this other government.
There is something I really liked, the George Marshall approach that was on that website. It's on the KB website under the schedule where my show is, actually.
Okay.
If you check out his link, it's like a little 20-minute video. I thought it was great, and maybe we could talk about that a little, Anna, too.
Okay. Well, sorry to go off on you.
Yeah.
No.
It gets the emotions going.
If you keep up with current events, it doesn't look good.
Yeah. Yeah.
No. And I share your frustration, and I would say, I mean, I do not in any way claim that communication and messaging is the silver bullet here. I mean, I think it's part of a bigger puzzle, and you know, every little bit that we do is hopefully chipping away at the...
Well, thanks for your time anyway. I just had to vent that.
No, thank you, John.
I appreciate it.
All right, bye.
Bye. Okay, and now we have another caller that we can try to take a little time with. I just want to let people know again, you're listening to The Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland with me, and she's a communications strategist at Sightline Institute, an environmental think tank that's trying to work on sustainable solutions for the Pacific Northwest. And Anna, I guess our next caller calls himself a skeptic. So and what's your name?
Skeptic A.
Skeptic A?
Well, you'll probably have Skeptic B before too long.
Okay, okay. So maybe you could just have a little conversation here with Anna, and we can just see how that goes. You know, we can try it for maybe 5 or 10 minutes, okay?
Well, however long it goes. What I notice in this public polemic on this issue is the insistence on using this psychological pejorative. And even when referring to some of the top climate scientists in the world who are not in agreement with the catastrophic anthropogenic global warming agenda, they're referred to as deniers. And I'm talking about people who've been in the field forever, some of the top people. You know that some of the top people are not on board with this.
Okay, Anna, what would you say?
Well, I don't really want to debate the science, but I will say that, 97% of those working on climate science, and that's not just a handful of smart people, that's thousands of people in hundreds of countries around the world, agree that pollution from burning coal and oil and gasoline is loading up the atmosphere with heat-trapping gases, and that we are seeing... global trends toward a warmer climate that holds more precipitation, and that the impacts are starting to be clear right now across the globe, but also in our backyard. And, of course, science is an evolving and, hotly debated within the fields enterprise, but that's what makes it work. And, you know, there's a great analogy about whether if you would listen to the 97 doctors who said that you should take one set of precautions or you know, treatment to make your kid feel better, or whether you'd listen to the 3 who said just leave it alone. And I would definitely take the word of the 97.
And I guess partly maybe to sort of further this, and that's another one I read, was like, are you going to listen to the 97 engineers who say the plane is going to crash if you were going to get on that plane? It's that those kinds of arguments are still arguments, but where are we? Like, what was your name again? Skeptic A?
Skeptic A.
Okay. In terms of just your values as a human being, I mean, maybe we could start talking about that, like you know, you wanting a healthy planet for your child, that kind of thing. I mean, maybe we could just, if we could just reach a little bit of common ground, I think we might
sure,
be able to.
Sure, that's fine. Yes, I'm a lifelong environmentalist. I'm a strong supporter of clean air, clean water, clean soil, all the essentials that are surrounding us all the time, that are keeping us, you know, that if they are polluted and the toxins are attacking our body, then our bodies, then we better do something about it, because you know, that's obvious, right? However, having looked at the science in depth and studied it for some time now, I'm simply not convinced that CO2 is the culprit to begin with. Okay, there is global warming. There's no doubt about that. And you know, getting back to my question, or my point, I should say, to refer to anybody who questions the dominant paradigm on this issue as a denier, using a psychological pejorative like that, that does not advance the discussion. That tends to shut it down. But at any rate, my insistence on even doing anything about this in terms of engaging the polemic, that is because the science, in order to inform and policy, needs to be solid. People are going to resist all environmental action because they see unsettled science in the climate science world being pushed as settled science, then that damages all environmentalism. And that's why I engage this polemic, because I see the issue as being damaging to the overall cause of environmentalism.
Anna, would you say that what Skeptic A here is saying is that it basically the sense of people who disagree feeling disrespected is part of the way that we need to sort of, you know, learn how to communicate better, or learn just...
I absolutely think that's true, especially having a one-on-one conversation with someone like Skeptic A here. You know, there are so many ways that we can find common ground and understand each other as people who have families and live in places we love and care about the future. And I'm so glad that he brought up the fact that he is concerned about clean air and clean water and healthy, safe food, and I forget all the other things that you listed. But that brings up for me this sense that I want to leave the world a better place than I found it, and we have an opportunity to have a real win-win, no matter what you think about the science. And everyone, you know, this gentleman sounds like he's intelligent and well-informed, or, you know, well-read anyway, that we can get together and think about solutions that not only help clean up our air and food and water, but also help us make our communities more vibrant and help us figure out how to be competitive in an energy market that's changing across the world, you know, how to make our energy production local and domestic and clean and abundant. And it sounds like those are places where he and I would certainly agree. You know, we all want to provide a better life for our kids and our grandkids, and Americans have a strong history of, you know, overcoming big challenges, whether we want to frame it as climate change or as our energy challenges going forward. We know that we can rise to the challenges and succeed, and that nothing should stand in our way, whether it's sort of a political or science debate, or whether it's big oil companies who want to protect profit over sort of an inevitable evolution toward different energy sources.
Right. Do we have another caller then? Okay, and what was your name? Joanne, what would you like to ask or say?
Yes, I'd like to say my opinion about why people are standing on the sidelines and not putting themselves out to this issue and many other issues in this country. I believe this, that some of the reason is because we've been trained by the mental health system not to show any kind of anger or frustration for problems means that we're mentally ill. And also, I think people have seen how the Occupy people and events in this country, how they were punished and neutralized. Anyway, I'll get off the air.
Anna, do you have a comment on that?
Well, it's an interesting comment, and I'm not sure I'm exactly sure what Joanne meant by the mental health connection, but I do think that there is sort of a complacency with kind of the status quo and how our voices are heard. And there's also quite a robust line of inquiry into sort of the need for people to work through or process anger and fear and anxiety about climate change in order to become more activated and better at talking about it and more engaged. And I think that, you know, the other side of that coin is that showing our anger can have some influence, ideally, on our elected officials, you know, when we really speak out about an issue and when it moves up from being the lowest ranked priority to a higher ranked priority because we are actually expressing our anger and fear about it, that we can have some political influence as well and activate our family members and our neighbors and our friends and our coworkers who may be concerned but may not know exactly how to get involved or may not feel that they're informed enough or equipped enough to get involved in the political process.
We're having another caller, Brant, but I just want to ask one quick question and then we can go to Brant.
Sure.
Part of this is that we do need to be talking with friends and family. I read a lot of stuff that our friends and our family are actually most likely to be the people that influence us. Americans say that these are the people that they actually listen to and where they get their opinions. And I think part of the reason that some of the opinions are hardening around this is that that the people who disagree with it are getting very much confirmed by the people in their set. And same thing with the people who are maybe more environmentally worried about it. And that unless we start talking about it with all the different uncles and aunts and people that we work with and this and that and the other, it's just going to keep getting more. We have to have more of an exchange of a conversation and allow ourselves to talk to the people that we might be able to influence.
That's absolutely true, and I think you tapped into something very key here, is that I think Dave, he's at grist.org, that talking about climate change, even among those who are concerned, is something akin to farting at a cocktail party.
Right. You feel like Debbie Downer.
Exactly. And, you know, a lot of us feel like we don't want to be that person who brings up this big, serious problem in social settings or around the Thanksgiving. But I absolutely agree with you, Stephanie, that those are the opportunities not to bring everybody down necessarily, but to simply say in the clearest terms that you can muster why you care about it and why you think that it's an important issue and the impacts that we're facing in the next 50 to 100 years. But you can talk about, you know, your concerns for your kids or your family or, you know, global, geo-global politics.
Right. And you know, just that Oregon's having a drought right now. What's that about? But Brent, are you still there?
Yep. Yes,
okay.
I'm here.
What would you like to mention or say or ask?
Well, I've sort of been going down a different road. I've been listening to a lot of Guy McPherson, and he says things are happening a lot quicker than we realized, and we're basically nothing's going to change. I mean, we're done. And I'm sort of in that depression, despair type of situation. So I was wondering if you had any ways around that. You know, it's hard to keep on doing anything if you think he says 10 to 15 years, we'll see dramatic changes.
Yeah, and I feel your pain, Brent. I know that, you know, and I'm not an expert on the science. I'm more of a translator of science to messages that resonate with lay people. But we do know that we're locked into a certain amount of change, and that, you know, whether or not we change the status quo at this point, we're going to see some pretty severe impacts down the road. I think confronting your fear and grief about that is actually really powerful. The way you talked about it just now was not off-putting. It was, frankly, a really powerful message that I think would resonate with people in your circles. Of course, there is that element of despair which can shut us down or paralyze us, and I would just encourage you to look at all the movement that is happening, away, brain power that's being put into fixing this problem, and there's a lot that's actually quite encouraging and can buoy the spirits a little bit.
Well, part of it might be just finding other people that do resonate with this issue, finding groups that are working on it, like 350.org. And people aren't even sending letters to their congressmen. I mean, just signing petitions, sending letters. And in a certain way, it is incredibly frustrating that nothing is happening. But at least there's, basically, how did we stop? It's like it has to be something that really galvanizes us. And I think part of the reason we stopped the Vietnam War was that there was enough young people at that time, and their families were concerned about them, who were going to be sent over and killed, that they just said, no, we don't want to do that. People were just being conscripted. And in a certain way, we're all being conscripted to be a part of a climate crisis. And how can we just say, no, I don't want to go there, you know, and get together on this? And maybe Paul Cienfuegos in the beginning was right, just saying, you know, just starting to work more in our communities.
I think that's true. And also holding, as you said, holding our elected officials accountable, holding our media accountable.
Right.
To actually cover this as a viable story that's not just relegated to the environmental realm, but is cast as we're past that. We're seeing anybody can look out their window and start to notice things about what's happening. If you're a gardener or farmer, you'll notice it even more acutely. You know, that spring is coming weeks earlier, that we're seeing bigger extremes, that we're dealing with more and more frequent and intense kinds of weather, from
weird
drought
weather,
and wildfires and flooding, that we've seen all in the last, you know, 6 months.
Yeah. I just want to let people know again, I'm speaking with Anna Fahey, a communications strategist. I'm Stephanie Potter here with the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. And we do have another caller, Natano?
Yeah, hi.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Well, I've got the good news about the really bad news.
Okay, good.
Because, you know, it's, we should, the bad news is we're over the falls. The good news is there's really nothing we can do about it. And it's better to have fun and enjoy your days on a dying planet rather than moping about it. And not that...
Carpe diem, as it were.
Right. Not that we should give up trying to fix carbon wherever we can, because before Roger Revelle died, he was the guy that was influential over Al Gore and got Al Gore to, or inspired Al Gore to make the Inconvenient Truth. I was able to talk to him after a lecture in 92, and I asked him, I said, do you think we'll ever get control of the media so we can, turn this ship around in time before, it's too late? And he just shook his head no. He was about 92, I think, at the time, but he was very pessimistic about the future. And the bottom line is, if we could get control of the media and get people to realize that it's not liberal, and that the fallacy of Republicans being conservative and all these other lies that are out there, if we can get control of the media, we could save it. But until we get control of the media, all they have to do is throw those three fossil fuel climate scientists, propagandists on after a whole bunch of really scientists, and they can give these propagandists the last word. And most liberals and average citizens will say, oh, good. Well, these guys say that there's no problem, so I don't really have to worry about it. But the truth is, we're over the falls, and the guy earlier said something about 15 to 20 years, and he's right. That's about all the time we have before the sea level rises to the point where they're going to inundate all the nuclear plants. Well, and most of the nuclear plants are at sea level, and what we ought to be doing right now is decommissioning all sea level reactors and getting the cores up and out of them, because it takes about 7 years to cool these things down.
Okay, one thing I wanted to just editorial board that we have to start talking. That was media. I was so impressed that we have to start talking about this. It's a real issue, just as you said. The science is, and Bernie Sanders and 15 other senators are saying it was atrocious that on the Sunday news programs, only 8 minutes in all of 2012 were talking about the climate, and he's trying to get some kind of a climate media task force going to get the media to start talking about it.
That's the only solution.
Yeah, but
we have to do that.
But anyway, Anna, do you have some comments on this?
Well, I agree about the media, obviously, and I also understand the impulse to sort of throw up our hands. But I would say that there's a great, an enormous amount of satisfaction that we can have, that we can find. And I also wanted to mention that there's this sense of, especially among environmentalists and folks who are concerned about pollution and the impact that we're having on the planet, is that there's sort of this sense of guilt about climate change, about sort of not doing enough or not being able to change our ways. I mean, all of us need to somehow commute to work, and all of us are sort of locked into the infrastructure and the systems that we inherited. But there are some compelling arguments for federal or state-level climate policy solutions that actually take some of that guilt and burden off the individual. And I think that that's really encouraging. On carbon allows us to, as the caller said, sort of sit back and relax a little bit. It's not about the counting the number of miles that we drive. It's about changing our whole economic system so that we are rewarding those who pollute less and acknowledging the true cost of climate warming pollution for those who pollute. And I think that that's it's an argument that may or may not appeal to conservatives as well as progressives, but there are certainly conservatives who are making the argument for a carbon pollution tax as a way to fix market distortions, recognize the full costs of energy that are sort of just hidden at this point, and essentially just to tax the bad and not the good. You tax what you want to get more of, or excuse me, you tax what you want less of and cut taxes on what you want more of, as we would with income or any other positive, beneficial aspect of our economy. And I'm hoping that some of those economic and kind of opportunity messages resonate a little bit more than some of the tricky messages about science. And unfortunately, science has become politicized in this case. If we can move past those debate frames, we can also probably find ways to move past some of that sense of despair.
What can we start to make happen? And I think one thing I saw was that young people are, this was in your website, there's 74% of young independents and 53% of even young Republicans characterize deniers as, quote, ignorant or out of touch or crazy. So, I mean, there is a sense more that there is some kind of a consensus, at least among young people, that this is a real thing. I was hopeful. Anyway,
yes,
we have a caller.
There is hope.
Is a fellow named Jack on the phone?
Yeah, how you doing?
Hi, we've got just a few minutes, so just say this quick because I want to do a wrap-up here, okay?
Okay, I'll make it quick. Charleston, West Virginia, what's going on there with their pollution and how there are probably signs of things that were to be, but because of the political infrastructure there, things were kept quiet, and they're being kept quiet today. I listen to NPR, and they don't bring up anything that, let's say, the WKPFK is saying about what's going on there and how that directly ties into this global warming issue and people's overall emotions about it and how bad does it have to get. And I mean, people are getting sick in Charleston right now, and there seems to be a media brownout about it. So I'll have a good day, and bye-bye.
Well, thank you. And okay, Anna, so again, the media is a huge part of this. If we can get our media more involved, maybe it's just writing letters or to the paper or something. How?
Well, I am also not an expert in media reform, although it's something I'm very interested in and eager to see more of. It goes in the same category as sort of reforming some of the systems for having regular citizens' voices heard in our democracy and getting some of big money out of politics. Media is also most oftentimes about big money. But they, you know, the news media also responds to the wants and needs of their audience because they're a business. So some of the really encouraging media reform efforts is also another place to go. But again, that's not my area.
Right, but Media Matters, for instance, I think is a very good organization for people maybe
Absolutely.
To check out. Again, though, when we're talking with people, it's to talk about our own experience with this, our own. I liked another thing George Marshall said, to talk about even your own personal journey, because almost none of us, you know, especially older people, were concerned about the climate at all. You know, 30 years ago, I should have been in 1965. I wasn't. I was still driving my car, you know, endlessly in the 90s. Mm-hmm. It didn't seem like I didn't get it until maybe in the last 10-15 years. And so to talk about your own journey is a huge part of this, would you say?
I would say. I put that in the same kind of strategy category as making this personal, saying why you care, why it matters to you, and talking about whether you had a kind of a epiphany or a moment where it all came together. So, you know, if I were to kind of list some strategies, I would say making it personal is maybe at the top of the list, reinforcing the basics, because we can't assume that people have fully, absorbed the basic science. We don't have to get complicated or detailed. Just say that it's happening, we're seeing impacts, and that humans are the cause. A place where you can talk about extreme weather changes that you're observing. Of course, weather is not always connected to climate change, But there are many scientists who are now saying that there's no weather that is not influenced by climate change anymore.
Wow.
And another kind of nice analogy that I heard the other day from a respected climate scientist was that climate is sort of the personality and weather is the mood. And, you know, we're kind of poking sticks at the personality until there's a shift and the moods are getting worse.
Right, a really bad mood.
Right. And then I would, you know, I recommend people taking this out of the environmental frame. That helps us take it out of the debate frame as well, so that we're talking about health. Just as our skeptic caller said, we're talking about air quality, we're talking about food, we're talking about sort of the way we live and our, you know, the impacts on our bodies and our health. We're talking about the economy, and certainly focusing on opportunities for the economy and, you know, a healthy shift to cleaner energy sources and efficiency. And then, as you said, Stephanie, finding common ground. And I think that we should take seriously the skeptics' comment about some of the terms that may be insulting. We need to find places where we actually overlap with the folks we're trying to talk to, places where we agree, our core values, our hopes and dreams, our fears and anxieties, and, you know, sort of tell compelling stories about climate. You know, we're doing this because we owe it to our kids. No one should doubt Americans' ingenuity and resolve, and nothing should stand in our way. And that we're seeing, you know, that there is progress. You know, we could be moving forward a lot quicker if there weren't a kind of a stranglehold on our progress coming from those interested in keeping us on fossil fuels.
Right, if there weren't the blockages, but there are alarmists. So there's that number, and I'm not sure what it takes to actually galvanize a whole society, but it seems like that would be a good start if the alarmists could not just sink into despair, maybe, right?
Absolutely. And I think part of that is motivating the rest of the majority of American people who are way out ahead of their elected officials on this issue. I mean, that is very encouraging to me anyway, even though it's about stalled progress and money in politics and media reform and sort of despair about our voices not being heard. We do see that significant majorities of Americans, from those of us in our, you know, progressive bubble in Seattle or Portland, to folks in Texas and the reddest states in the nation, who are, you know, in the high 70s%, because, you know, there are other concerns that distract us. It's actually a luxury to be concerned about climate change when you're trying to get food on the table and take care of your kids and get by.
Right.
But the concern is there, and I think that there are ways to tap into that. And for me, that's encouraging.
Your website again is Sightline Daily, or what was that?
Sightline.org. You can find links from there to our blog, all kinds of policy resources and communications and messaging resources.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show. You've been listening to The Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter, and my guest has been Anna Fahey, a communications strategist at Sightline Institute, trying to help get us all to talk about this really important topic of climate. And I want to just thank Tammy for your engineering, and thank all of you for listening.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you.
just moments before noon here on KBOO Portland. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Museum of the Oregon Territory, presenting Willamette Falls, Where the Future Began. It's a day of exhibits, papermaking, workshops, film, and tribal art. Saturday, February 1st in Oregon City, Willamette Falls will include a blessing song by the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, the Once Lost Fish Mural by Alex Schoenberg, a kids' concert by Spider Moccasin, and more. Details at clackamashistory.org. Thanks for tuning in to KBOO this morning. Stay tuned for jazz. Coming right up, we've got noon headlines from the news department. Thank you, KBOO, over and out. This is KBOO Headline News at Noon for January 22, 2014. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Patrick Wilson. In local news, Multnomah County Republicans responded to local and national criticism for a planned raffle in which an AR-15 rifle is a prize. Critics were appalled that this prize was designed to commemorate Martin Luther King and President Abraham Lincoln, both strongly opposed to violence and both shot to death. Republicans maintain their press release was easily misunderstood and went on to apologize if people were hurt by the message because of misinterpretations by those who disagree politically. They also said they would try to communicate more clearly in the future. A spokesman for Holy Trinity Greek Orthodox Church said the church will no longer host the Lincoln Day dinner because of objections to the rifle prize.
Because of disruptions Monday at North Portland's Terminal 6, the state's biggest cargo terminal in Portland, the port operator issued last-minute gate restrictions on freight deliveries for Tuesday. The restriction only allowed truckers to pick up and drop off empty containers in the morning and collect only full boxes in the afternoon. This caused major congestion on North Marine Drive, where mile-long lines have once again become common. Hanjin, a South Korean ocean cargo carrier, will announce soon whether their ships will continue calling on Portland, as labor strife has snarled cargo and caused vessels to bypass the city. If the port's biggest shipper pulls out, there will be additional transport fees for shipping containers by truck and rail from California and Washington. This will also jeopardize local jobs.
In national news, lawmakers in New Jersey are creating a special joint state-senate committee to investigate the George Washington Bridge traffic jams and other alleged abuses of power by Governor Chris Christie. Senate Majority Leader Loretta Weinberg and Assemblyman John Wisniewski will serve as co-chairs. The decision resulted from intense behind-the-scenes negotiations between Democratic lawmakers. The committee will be heavily represented by Democrats who control both.
This is KBOO Headline News at Noon for January 22, 2014. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Patrick Wilson. In local news, Multnomah County Republicans responded to local and national criticism for a planned raffle in which an AR-15 rifle is a prize. Critics were appalled that this prize was designed to commemorate Martin Luther King and President Abraham Lincoln, both strongly opposed to violence, and both saying their press release was easily misunderstood and went on to apologize if people were hurt by the message because of misinterpretations by those who disagree politically. They also said they would try to communicate more clearly in the future. A spokesman for Holy Trinity Greek Orthodox Church said the church will no longer host the Lincoln Day dinner because of objections to the rifle prize.
Because of disruptions Monday at North Portland's Terminal 6, the state's biggest cargo terminal in Portland, the port operator issued last-minute gate restrictions on freight deliveries for Tuesday. The restriction only allowed truckers to pick up and drop off empty containers in the morning and collect only full boxes in the afternoon. This caused major congestion on North Marine Drive, where mile-long lines have once again become common. Hanjin, a South Korean ocean cargo carrier, will announce soon whether their ships will continue calling on Portland, as labor strife has snarled cargo and caused vessels to bypass the city. If the port's biggest shipper pulls out, there will be additional transport fees for shipping containers by truck and rail from California and Washington local jobs.
In national news, lawmakers in New Jersey are creating a special joint state-senate committee to investigate the George Washington Bridge traffic jams and other alleged abuses of power by Governor Chris Christie. Senate Majority Leader Loretta Weinberg and Assemblyman John Wisniewski will serve as co-chairs. The decision resulted